became a minister, and the thing about the post office is nobody ever thinks about them until something goes wrong with the mail. Same thing with the sound booth. Nobody thinks about it until something happens that goes wrong. We thank you. We're continuing in our study of the Gospel of John, and today we come to chapter 9. So if you have a Bible, I invite you to turn with me to John's Gospel, chapter 9, and I'll begin in just a moment. We come to what I said earlier is my favorite story in the New Testament. It's a story that takes up a whole chapter, but yet, just like the woman at the well, we never get the name of the main character. And maybe that's the reason that this is so, because this fellow represents what happens to a lot of people in life. Maybe not being physically healed so much as seeing the spiritual truth, gaining spiritual vision. Because like the man in the story, we can all come and see the light of truth. Jesus had spoken at the Festival of Tabernacles. We've been studying that for the last 2 weeks, that he made several statements there. And one of the things he said was a bold claim when he stood up in front of four burning candelabras, which were so large and so bright that they filled up the entire city of Jerusalem at night. And Jesus stood up one evening in front of those candelabras and cried out, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Now this story follows that claim by only a few days, and at its heart, this story is an acted parable. Now it's a true story, it actually happened, but it's an acted parable in the sense that it demonstrated the truth of what Jesus was saying that night. He is the light of the world. So let's begin chapter 9, first 7 verses I call the strange remedy. Listen along, and you can watch it on the screen as we read. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said this, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. This chapter begins with the statement that Jesus saw a man blind from birth. Now I want to tell you that there were lots of people in Jerusalem that had infirmities. This fellow was not the only person in Jerusalem that had a problem. But Jesus put his eyes on him. He saw him. He picked him out. This man caught Jesus' attention. And note that he was born blind. He had this infirmity from birth. And when the disciples saw him, they asked a sort of a theological question. They said, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Now that sounds crazy to us. But in their day, there was a thought in Jewish theology that if a person was born with an infirmity, it must either mean that their parents sinned and God was punishing them through the infirmity of the child, or that somehow, as a fetus in a mother's womb, the baby had sinned. Now, both of those are false. Both of those are not true. Not at all. But they thought that way. And Jesus said, "Well, neither one. Neither one. But there's something else that's going to happen." You see, to the disciples, this man was the subject of a theological discussion. But to Jesus, this man was a human being. And God cared about him. And Jesus emphasized to the disciples that the opportunity to minister to people like him was short. You have to work while it's day. Nighttime is coming when you can't work. That's a figure of speech, meaning the time, the opportunity is short. And in Jesus' own experience, in a few months, he was going to be crucified. Remember, this was October. We talked about this over the last 2 weeks. This was the Festival of Tabernacles in October, and come April, he would be on the cross. Disciples didn't realize that, but it was true. Jesus said, "We must work the works of God while you have the chance." And that spells out the reason that we need to be careful to do what we can do for others while we have the chance. Because you never know how long that opportunity is going to last. Well, Jesus said, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Well, he's always the light of the world. But when he was physically here, he was a very bright light. And he was about to do something very strange. He walked over to this blind man, knelt down beside him. I bet the blind man could smell Jesus' hair and smell his clothes. And then Jesus spit on the ground. And using his fingers, he began to churn the dirt into mud. And then taking the mud, he began to rub it onto the eyelids of the blind man. And I bet everybody in the crowd was looking at this, saying, whoa, what's happening here? Well, there was a popular thought in that day that the spittle of a great man had healing properties. They would think that if the spit, this is strange to us, but they thought the spit of a great man could actually have some healing effect. And perhaps this blind man heard that and knew that concept because he doesn't know Jesus. He's not a disciple of Jesus. He's just a guy on the side of the road. But he understands that here's a rabbi that's doing this to me. Maybe there's something to it. Jesus took that mud, rubbed it on his eyelids, and then Jesus stood up and gazed down at this blind man who's sitting on the ground with his cup begging for money, and Jesus gives him a command. He says, go. Wash in the pool of Siloam. Jesus is telling him to get up and walk down to the lower part of the city with mud on his eyes and then wash it off. That's a strange command. John tells us that the word Siloam means sent. And it really does. Let me give you the context here. The pool of Siloam was a man-made pool in the lower part of Jerusalem. In fact, it was there, we talked 2 weeks ago, that the high priest would get a pitcher of water in a golden pitcher and would carry it up for as part of the festival of tabernacle ceremony. That pool, the name Siloam means sent, because the water is literally sent into the city. It was constructed many centuries ago in Jesus' day during the days of King Hezekiah. And what happened was this. King Hezekiah, being a practical king, realized that if his country was attacked and his city was surrounded by the enemies, they could cut off their water supply. And so King Hezekiah gave his engineers an order. He said, find a way to get the water from the Kidron Valley into Jerusalem. And so his engineers had to come up with a creative solution. And in their BC technology, they did something amazing. They actually cut a conduit from the Kidron Valley all the way into Jerusalem, so that water could flow. They cut this conduit underground through solid rock in a zigzag pattern. They dug a tunnel that was 2 feet wide and 6 feet tall and went for 600 yards. Doing that with BC technology. Amazing, incredible act of engineering. And thus the water from the spring outside the city could flow into this man-made pool inside the city. And so the name of the pool was called Siloam, sent. And this day, Jesus was ordering this beggar, this man, he was sending him. This man was being sent by the one sent from heaven to go to this pool. Go. Wash the pool of Siloam. That's not just down the street. It's down in the lower part of the city. You've got to walk hundreds of yards to get to it. Would he do it? Would he obey this command? You know, the Bible has a principle that miracles begin with obedience. When we, as people, follow God's direction, as crazy as it might sound, that's when miracles can be born. This was a test of faith for this blind man. And he doesn't know a whole lot about Jesus. But he knows that Jesus is respected as a rabbi. So he got up. He stood himself up and got his cane and slowly began to make his way through the crowd as everybody was staring at him and moving them apart. He began to make his way downhill, down alleys and down the lanes, all the way down to the lowest part of the city where the pool was. The eyes of the people probably watched him go, and then they turned their eyes back to Jesus, and Jesus continued walking along and talking and teaching the crowd. Somehow he made his way down to that pool. When he got down there, he laid down his cane. He got back down on his knees. The water was crystal clear, though he couldn't know that. All he knew is he was following this command of this rabbi. And just permit me a little imagination here. I just sort of read this into the text. Perhaps this man felt like he was a spectacle. He had walked down the hills to the pool with mud on his face. People probably snickered when they saw him. And he probably thought to himself, is this ridiculous? What am I doing here? But he obeyed the command and he took his hands and he took them and placed them in the water. They splashed his face with the water. And then he took his hands and splashed his face some more, began to rub his eyes and wash that mud off. And all of a sudden, something began to happen. He began to sense a change, a dizziness in his forehead and a strange feeling in his eyes. And as he washed the mud off his eyes some more, all of a sudden he felt pain. Oh, it hurts. Light. The first time in his life, his eyes took in light. Probably startled for a couple of minutes. Then he began to look at what was in front of him. The first thing he saw was his own hands. And then he saw the water flowing in front of him. And he looked over and he saw his cane that he had used all his life to walk. And he looked up and saw people who were walking around beside this man-made pool. And he was amazed at what they looked like. And he was amazed at the colors that they had. He probably sat there with incredible awe for many minutes. Then looking perhaps down at the pool one last time, he saw something floating in the water in front of him. He might have even reached down to see, to grab it, and his hand hit only the water. And then he remembered something that his parents had told him about pools. The pools can reflect things. And he looked, and for the first time in his life, he saw a reflection of his own face. He was healed. Amazing. What a strange way to do it. But he was healed. Somehow, and we don't know how, he made his way back to his old neighborhood. It was the neighborhood where he lived, where he grew up, but everything was different now. He could see the colors. He could see people. And when they spoke, he could recognize them because all he knew was the sound of their voices. He could see a neighbor who had a bald head and another man who had a long beard. And he could hear the voice of a lady who was always loud and lived next door. And when people spoke, he could recognize them. And they began to look at him. It was incredible. It was the same old neighborhood, but now everything was new. Everything was different. And he was a different man. So let's continue on with the text, verses 8 through 12, I call the unknown healer. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is not this the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." The healed man returned to his neighborhood and caused quite a commotion. People saw him and say, "Wait a minute, that looks like the guy that was blind that's always begging." And other people said, "Well, he must look like him, but it can't be him. This man's walking around." And he said, "It's me! It's me! I'm the one!" Can you imagine the commotion that caused? They asked him, "How did this happen?" And all he knew was, "A man named Jesus touched my eyes with some mud." What a strange thing. He told me to go down to the pool in the low part of the city and wash it off. And I did that. And now I can see. I can see you. He met all the people in his neighborhood excited. Probably spent a couple of hours talking with people that he had heard all his life. Perhaps he even met his parents. Neighbors didn't know what to do with him. But they decided that probably the best thing is to take him down to church. Take him down to the local synagogue. Now there were, as I learned in my study, not only the great temple in Jerusalem, but there were dozens of synagogues in Jerusalem in that day. And so this group decided that they would take him to the local synagogue. So let's continue the story in verses 13 through 17, I call the awkward argument. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees asked him again how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my face, on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "Well, what do you say about him since he opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." The neighbors took him to their local synagogue. The Pharisees were still there. The Pharisees were the primary teachers in the synagogues. They were the rabbis. And so the neighbors took him to their local church, their local synagogue, and told their local preachers, their rabbis, what had happened. The Pharisees were very interested in this story. And they called the healed man over, and they asked him to give his version of it, and he did. But there was a big problem for these Pharisees, because you see, that day was a Sabbath. They had just finished their services that morning before. That was a Sabbath. And to them, healing could not be done on a Sabbath day. Now, again, this sounds very strange to us. It's not our culture. But we studied a couple of years ago, I did a series on the Ten Commandments. And one of those commandments has to do with honoring God on the Sabbath. And that was remembering God's work of creation and remembering that they were to rest from the Sabbath and not do ordinary work on the Sabbath day. Now, the truth is, God meant for it to be a day for the Jews to remember Him and rest and recognize His sovereignty and authority and not do the every ordinary work that they would typically do. It did not mean they couldn't do anything. But the Pharisees, over the years, had changed the interpretation. And they had changed it to mean that nobody could do anything on the Sabbath day. And they came up with 39 different categories of what work was. 39 different categories. And in one of those categories was healing. You couldn't heal on the Sabbath because that would be work. In fact, they even had the idea that if somebody broke a bone, it couldn't be set until the next day. Because if you set the bone, that would be work. Isn't that crazy? So Jesus healed this man on a Sabbath day. And so in the eyes of these guys, these Pharisees, Jesus can't be from God because he did work on the Sabbath. And according to our tradition, nobody can work on the Sabbath day. And so an argument broke out. You see, some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God." But the others said, "Well, wait a minute. How could a person who's a sinner do a miracle like this?" And then there began a discussion, an argument between these two groups of Pharisees. And this argument broke out. And the issue is whether or not a sinful man can perform miracles and can a good miracle come from a sinful person. And all the while, the healed man was listening to this argument, he's watching his local rabbis talk about him and his healing and arguing about whether or not it was good. He thought to himself, how can it not be good? How can it not be wonderful? How can this not be something we all praise God for? After a few minutes of arguing with each other, the rabbis turned to the healed man and said, "Well, what do you think about him, boy?" I'm improvising. What do you think about him, boy? Since you're the one who got your eyes opened. The old man probably swallowed hard. He looked back at these religious teachers, these know-it-alls, with their frustrated faces looking at him. And then he spoke, "Well, he's a prophet." That's all he knew to say. He'd been taught all his life that great prophets of God could do miracles by the power of God. But this didn't seem to satisfy the Pharisees. You see, they were actually hoping that they could find out that there was a mistake somewhere, that either the healed man was not healed on the Sabbath or it really wasn't Jesus who did it. They weren't sure about this so-called miracle. So they want to investigate a little bit more. So let's continue on in our text, verses 18 through 23, I call the parents' paradox. The Jews did not believe that he had been born blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son, and he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know. Nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. Now, when John uses the term the Jews, he means Jewish leaders, religious teachers. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask him." The rabbis were trying to investigate this miracle, and they were determined if this was some kind of a trick, they were going to figure it out. So they brought in the parents of the blind man. The neighbors helped them to get the right parents. And the neighbors got the parents there, and the parents come into the synagogue. All these people are standing around watching this scene. And there is their boy seeing with new eyes. That must have lifted their hearts. But there were also these rabbis staring with grimace on their face. And the old couple knew that they were in kind of a pickle. The Pharisees had already made a public announcement. Anybody who proclaimed that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah, that person would be excommunicated from the synagogue. Now that meant a little bit more than just being kicked out of church. When someone was excommunicated from the synagogue, they were cut off from society. No other Jew could sell to them, could buy from them, could help them, could have anything to do with them. They were considered banished. Can you imagine if everybody in your culture, everybody in your town had to ignore you? You couldn't buy anything at any store. You couldn't get anything because you were banished from the synagogue. That means you're excommunicated from society. That was a powerful deterrent. So this old couple, looking at their boy and looking at the Pharisees, they were very careful in the way they answered this question. They said, "Well, we know it's our boy, and we certainly know he was born blind, but we don't know exactly how he got his sight. Just ask him. He's old enough. He can speak for himself. Ask him." Well, I imagine at this point the parents' eyes looked down at the floor. They could not face their son in their cowardice. And I imagine that perhaps the boy looked back at them with a little bit of tears in his eyes. Well, after this, the parents were released. The crowd of neighbors were told to go, empty the room. "We will continue this investigation in private now." And that's what they did. So as we read again in the text, verses 24 and following, we have what I call the beggar's experience. So for a second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, Whether he's a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, though I was blind, now I see. They said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, I told you already. You would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to be his disciples too? And they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not even know where he's from. For the second time, the rabbis interrogated the healed man. They seemed to focus on the method that Jesus used to heal him. They should have been investigating the healer, not the method. But they were fixed on how Jesus made this miracle happen. And they told the healed man, give glory to God. Now that means two things. First of all, they're telling him as rabbis, give God the glory, not this carpenter from Nazareth. Give God the glory. But the second thing is they're actually putting him under oath. You see, that in their day and age was the Jewish version of saying, I pledge to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God, as we say in American courtrooms. This was their version of saying that. Give glory to God. You're under oath. You got to tell the truth now. Don't mince any words. We know this man is a sinner. So they told him what they wanted him to say. They wanted him to agree with them. Agree with this viewpoint, you can go. A sinner couldn't do a work of God on the Sabbath. This Jesus, this rabbi from Nazareth, he broke the Sabbath by doing a healing. He can't possibly be from God. But the healed man couldn't agree with that. In fact, he couldn't understand this at all. Now, he had no religious training. He had no education. He never could go to school. He was blind. He didn't know their fancy theology. But he knew what had happened to him. This morning, he was blind. This afternoon, he could see. And so he looked at these religious leaders, and he said the only thing he knew. Verse 25, he says, whether he's a sinner, how you define that, I don't know. I don't know theology like you boys do. But one thing I do know, I was blind. Now I see. You know, there's no saying that a man with an experience is never at the mercy of a man with an argument. This man had experience. He knew the helplessness of being blind. He knew the humiliation of being a beggar. And he knew the situation of that morning. Jesus had touched him. Jesus had ordered him to go to a pool, wash in that pool, and God had healed him. He knew his life before, and he knew his life now. He knew the change, the wonderful change. But the Pharisees just kept focusing on the method. That seemed to be important to them. What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? The healed man got impatient. He said, I told you already. I've told you everything I know. Then he got a little bit sarcastic. You want to be his disciples too? And they exploded in anger and they said, you are his disciples. We're disciples of Moses. In their pride and their arrogance, these were Pharisees. Remember I told you the word Pharisee means separated one. That's what they were. That's what they thought of themselves. They were the best. They were the most religious. They were the high class. They were it. And everybody else was beneath them. That's the way they thought. They were the teachers of the law. They followed Moses, not some country preachers from Galilee. One of these Pharisees pointed his finger at the healed man and said in his own sarcasm, we know that God has spoken to Moses. But as for this man, we don't know where he comes from. Heads of the other men nodded in agreement. They had no regard for this country preacher, Jesus. None at all. The healed man was stunned. Stunned at their attitude. Stunned at their ignorance. They were supposed to be the teachers. They were supposed to be the ones who understood things. They didn't know where Jesus came from. But the healed man knew something. He knew something very real. You see, he had known the difficulty of darkness. He had known the taste of poverty. Now he knew the wonder of seeing, looking, gazing, experiencing visions of colors and shapes, all because of Rabbi Jesus. He may not have had their education, but standing before these so-called learned men, his faith began to grow. So let's continue in verses 30 through 34. I call the teacher's teacher. The man answered, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you dare to teach us?" And they cast him out. The healed man had heard enough. The rabbis might know their theology, but he knew his cure. And maybe he knew a little bit of Scripture too. Perhaps he remembered the words of the psalmist in Psalm 66 that says, "If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me." But God had heard. And God had used this Jesus to heal him. If Jesus was the sinner that these men claimed he was, that could never have happened. Jesus must have been sent from God. He must be a holy man. So the healed man challenged the teachers. He reminded them that in Israel's long history, nobody had ever been healed from blindness from birth. Not even Moses or Elijah or any of the other great prophets performed such a miracle. Surely this must prove that Jesus is a holy man. A man sent from God. Surely it must be obvious. But to these rabbis, the only thing that was obvious was that this uneducated lowlife was impertinent. How dare he assume that he could teach them? They took the same attitude that the disciples had asked this morning. "You were born entirely in sins. You're not like us, perfect and pure." And so action started. The Pharisees walked over to the healed man and they grabbed him. They began to drag him across the floor. They dragged him to the door of the synagogue, opened it, and pushed him through the door. They knocked him out, tossing him with a heave, and then slammed the door at his back. He fell onto the street. His body hit the cobblestone pavement. His face hit the ground. Dust flew into the air. Dust flew into his eyes. And for the first time in his life, his eyes burned. Water began to fill his new eyes. There he was, completely alone. Left by his neighbors, abandoned by his parents, and rejected by his rabbis. After a few minutes, he found himself sitting upon that pavement, just like he had done for so many years as a beggar. What had happened? Why had this happened? All he had done was tell the truth, and it's a wonderful truth. Why did it cause anger? Slowly, he got up, and as best he could, he tried to grope his way back toward his home. The afternoon was now gone. Evening was at hand. The sun was beginning to set, and a different kind of darkness began to engulf his world. So we come to the end of the story, verses 35 and following. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him. And it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. Jesus heard that this man had been cast out of his local synagogue. The leaders of the synagogue might not want him, but Jesus wanted him. He searched for him, and he found him. And when he saw him again, he went right up to him and asked him a question. Do you believe in the Son of Man? That voice. The healed man recognized that voice. That was the voice of the one who spoke to me this morning. That was the voice of the one who put mud on my eyes. That's the voice of the man who told me, go to Siloam and wash. That's Jesus. The healed man hurriedly replied, who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? With all his heart, he needed an answer. Jesus looked deeply into this man's new eyes. His voice was firm but tender. You have seen him, and it's he who's talking to you. The healed man gazed into the eyes of the one who gave him sight, and he knew his answer. Lord, I believe. And he dropped down to his knees and he worshiped him. There were people standing around. Some were followers of Jesus, some were not. And Jesus went on to speak to the crowd around him. He said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. What was he saying? Well, he wasn't saying that the purpose of his coming was for judgment. We all know that the purpose of Jesus' coming was for salvation. But do you know that the result of his coming causes a division? The consequence of his words causes division. Those who would see and believe in him would find the light of truth. Those who would see and reject him would be confirmed in darkness. They would stay in their blindness because of their rejection. These proud Pharisees tried to say that they weren't blind. Jesus said, well, you claim you're not blind. You are. You are. Well, the chapter ends here, but not the story. This blind man received more than just physical sight. He received salvation. He saw Jesus for who he was, and he believed in Jesus for who he is. And this blind man became a saved man. And he's in heaven today, looking at all the glories. He received a touch from the Master, a touch that changed his life. And this blind man became a new person. Jesus still touches people today. He still gives sight. Maybe not always physical sight. That'll happen in the resurrection. But Jesus gives spiritual sight to any person who will come to him. Each person who accepts Jesus in their heart will find that they too are transformed. They too become new. I want to end this sermon with something I don't do very often, but I want to read you a poem. This is going to end our message. It's a poem by a lady named Mary Brooks Welch. And I think it illustrates the story we're talking about. The poem is called The Touch of the Master's Hand. 'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bidding, good folks, he cried. Who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar? A dollar? Then two? Only two? $2, who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, and going for three. But no. From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. Then wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening the loose strings, he played a melody, pure and sweet as caroling angels sing. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, "What am I bid for this old violin?" And he held it up with a bow. $1,000. Who'll make it two? $2,000. Who'll make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, and going and gone, said he. The people cheered, but some of them cried, "We don't understand. What changed its worth?" And the man replied, "The touch of a master's hand." And many a man with a life out of tune, battered and scarred with sin, is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once, going twice, he's going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd can never understand the worth of a soul and the change that's wrought by the touch of the master's hand. Let's bow for prayer.